It wasn't. The summer was very different in two ways, three ways. On a personal level, I'll start work first. Last summer, the grievance office was very busy. I haven't finished the summer report yet, so I don't know my numbers yet, but I'm sure it's down from last summer. Last summer, I recall quite a few cases trying to informally resolve well into October, but very busy in July
and
August.
Those were carryovers from the previous
year. Oh, it was
year.
All spring stuff. Yeah. It was all RPT stuff for the most, not all, but 80% was RPT. This summer was very little of that. I mean, we had a few. Now, we've had two hearings in August, and we had a president's decision, which will come in the summer. So it won't look like there's no activity. But the number of inquiries, conferences, are definitely going to be down from last summer and phenomenally down from spring. It was a very busy spring. So, what to make of it, you know,
hard
and
to say, it swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, I would say last summer was exceptionally higher than the previous summer.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are some, and of course, my first summer I had 24 cases with two fellas, so
yeah, that was sort of unusual.
That was unusual. Yeah.
I would, in some senses, prefer to hear that you'd sort of run out of a job, but I don't think that's likely to happen. Based on the nature of organizations and
no, but also on a work level, as you know, part of the summer was spent, and actually I was hoping, we talked about some things to talk about today, and we might get to them, and you made a list for yourself and so forth, but one of the things I've put some effort into was this continuing discussion about revising the grievance procedure, and I understand that you met with Christine Zako and are also with Terry and Donna and gave some of your input into it. And that was one of the things I hope we could talk about today.
Actually, while the outcome of that was that Christine had written a draft.
Right.
And I essentially wrote a bunch of reactions to it and I sent it around to them. So I never really met with them.
Okay.
But I did share that information.
Uh-huh.
Let me just go out and grab my file on that. The grievance procedure, which has that per draft coming. On the whole, I thought the draft suggestions were quite useful. I did have some questions and issues. So.
I think I had shared with you my previous set that. I'd had a January set, and then I revised it after my annual review with Kim, and came up with a June set, and then it was off of that then Christine came in with one, and there's actually been, I've reacted to that, and she's revised it again, so I don't know which of those you would have gotten, but
well,
I had a
see.
Couple questions for you about that.
It's hard to say, based on her draft, which came with an email, which regretfully I didn't keep, but I, because of the time frame this arrived, I think I pretty much looked at it and commented on it almost immediately, and my memo or note to them is the 10th of July.
Makes sense.
So, here we are. It says the 8th of July on the top. So that's the one that I reacted to.
Okay.
I didn't see any other.
Yeah.
Versions that she had done earlier on.
Well, I reacted to it and asked Deb Bennett to look at it and let me know reactions. Got back to Christine. We met and then she drafted a f- few more revisions, and we're going to meet again later this week, so.
So you met between the version of the 8th of July and so on, so.
And there's another version.
Another version, which I've seen is the 8th of July.
It's some reactions to some of my suggestions, but it would be helpful if you were willing to share some of those. I can turn the tape off if you'd like. I don't care.
No, I don't care. I can go through it. Actually, what I might do is, in addition to just running through them, I would be more than willing just to give you a copy of the thing that I sent.
Maybe just to get your thoughts, because I know a couple things that I had suggested you and I chanted about, and a couple you weren't as certain about if they would fly or was it a good idea, and some of that I changed, but some didn't. And then Christine's suggestions, partly in light of, I guess, a university-wide effort to revise a number of policies and procedures and to sort of redraft the format of these things. So.
Yeah. Well, let me just is it
however you want to go.
Reasonable to make some reference to
the
version?
I have the version
There are three or four of them. A number of them occurred on the first page. I was concerned in the policy statement, there's a sentence that says that the procedures, the formal procedures described in this policy are intended to be used only when matters. And the question then is, what is the definition of formal procedures? Because if you can read it one way, it's conflicting with Section 3C that says there's informal resolution. That's part of the process. And so that was ambiguous. Under definitions, there was some ambiguity about who the definitions. Research associates are defined as faculty members when they're not defined as faculty members, although they're covered by the policy. But if you read it, it starts with faculty member, and then it lists research associate, academic specialist, librarian.
Okay.
Those are not faculty members, so you've got to have.
Okay.
And so I suggest there be some migration of those titles to C that talks about academic staff. Mm-hmm. But that's right.
That's happened. That has happened, by the way, in the next revision.
Item D is an old chestnut. Which is, as you and I have talked, and you have, is what is an administrator? And I don't think the definition in the 8th of July one is particularly clear. And in fact, it's clear in the sense that it's very narrow. So a non-academic unit administrator that has been delegated by the chair to do X or Y and someone agrees it. Do you really want a mode in which the chair is always the respondent? Because that would be the definition here. But again, once you go off into the mode of defining other people, you then get back into the morass that you've struggled with over the past several years. In item three, which is grievance procedures, the language that talks in the second paragraph and the fourth line about a faculty academic staff member's professional competence. Many of the issues that you address with, whether it be salaries, reappointment, promotion, and tenure, and judgments in part, not always wholly, at least in part or wholly, the person's professional competence. And if you leave that language in, maybe this is something you'd appreciate, but you're largely going to be put out of business, I think. And so that was ambiguous. Let us see. In filing agreements, or under filing agreements, this footnote 2 at the bottom of that page about waiving or extending time limits for good cause, and then a general definition of that. The question is whether that language is suggestive or restrictive. Because it seems to me that there are other instances in which you might extend the deadlines beyond the particular reasons that are raised. But I think you could read it alternatively as saying that it's generally defined. Or you could address the question by simply have an EG with, including but not limited to. Again, I don't know. I don't know whether there's a concern that there are frivolous reasons that the wicked FGO is using to extend. Let's see. Under footnote 3, one of the ambiguities of the 1, 2, 3, 4th line says the acceptability of proposed amendment, and any jurisdiction generated with the proposed amendment should be decided by the FGO at least 7 days before the hearing. And the question there is that judgment subject to appeal. In other words, the original grievance, you could say, for whatever set of reasons, is not within the orbit of the procedure. What about elements of the appeal? I didn't have anything on the next page. I suggested, and I think now in the modern electronic age, I mean, there's a philosophic argument about the question of going back to what I call the jury system rather than the standing a panel. I think there's some merit to that. I think that, well, there are really two issues to be direct about. There's a concern by some folks that you really have a catchment basis in which the people who run and get selected for to be the college reps on these are people who have some, in a general sense, axe to grind. The other problem is, as you know, is some colleges never fill up the roster, so you have some. And so there may be a merit in terms of the jury process. With, again, I don't know to what extent people would find this argument acceptable, but all the discussion about reform of governance and so on, if you throw it open to the general community, with, I would note, the proviso that you were suggesting here several months ago, that you only serve, you know, once in 3 years, it does sort of spread the opportunity to participate in an important place like governance process, which says, you know, we want to engage people. Now, I don't know whether faculty colleagues will view the chance to sit on a grievance panel being a way of participation, but there's that. But the point I'm really making in 4 is it seems to me that if you're going to do that for basic hearings, you should do it for appeals and not have a separate panel that only does questions of appeal. So that's number 4 under D. Under D, this is just a question. The response period is extended.
The provost one, or which one?
Well, if you look under college level hearings, number 4 and 5, it changes 4 to 21 and 5 to 28 days. And that plus the opportunity for extension, and I would say sotto voce, the inclination of the Office of Legal Affairs to always take much more time than will take as much time as they will get. I think to be crass, that if that particular issue is a concern, Mr. Noda will still ask for an extension after 28 days or 21 days. And so really the practical question is, I mean, it's not the end of the world, but if you look at the experience, do you really need to add another week as part of the formal process? Now, I don't have the information. You're the guy that has it. And if you're really, you know, extending 3/4 or 60% of all the cases, it may make sense. That was just a question that I raised.
Okay. I can make and respond to these if you want.
Yeah,
when you
whatever. Under E2, there is a, their editorials, if you look at, it says all faculty with appointment in the tenure system and librarians, and I think it probably should say appointed in the continuing appointment system rather than with continuing appointment status. That's just editorial.
Okay.
A hearing panel, a question under E4 has avoiding conflict of interest. no member of a hearing shall be from the same department as the grievance, and the question is whether one would want to add college as well. Now, certainly in the case of a residential college, which is not organized in departments, or nursing, you would probably not want to have someone from the college. But there may be a case to say that if you're going to pick people, and it's not unduly restrictive, you would get people from outside. There are arguments on both sides in terms of that. Number five, the procedure would change, in effect, go to tenured faculty rather than this mix of general folks and UCFT people. I think on a personal level, the UCFT members would say this is a great change, but there may be some Ark of the Covenant issue that's raised here that says, you know, we should have some involvement. I think it's a good suggestion and worth doing. It's not something to die on. Page 7, footnote 9, that says FGO hearing panel may request legal advice from the University Office of General Counsel, et cetera, et cetera. As a related matter, should one not formally specify, which is the operating practice, when the Office of the General Counsel will or will not represent a respondent? Because the practice has been that if an individual faculty member, as their right, chooses an external counsel, you know, a member of the bar, then there would be the possibility of an attorney, either from the General Counsel's office or someone designated by that office. But in the instance in which the person chose not to have counsel or an internal university counsel, which would include people with law degrees, that's been the practice, then there would be, you know, advice, commentary, and so on, but not representation. And that's a practice that I don't think is written down anywhere. It may be worth doing. Number 5, 3, I guess it is, number 13, hearing panels may consider evidence submitted by the party concerning the relative credentials of other faculty members in determining the merits of grievances, et cetera, et cetera. The practice has been what, without anything written in the procedure, has that been?
No, that's in there.
No, no, that's in the original, the current procedure? Oh, it is, okay. I just responded to that in error.
There's okay.
Something more there. Number category is 4B, University Appeals Panel. And appeals panel, the point that if you're going to use the jury system for original panels, why don't you use it for appeals? And you have the same problem in 4, whether you want to extend it to college. You know, no member of appeals should be from the same department as the grievance. As I say, at minimum, it seems to me you need to have a footnote that says such provision would apply to a faculty member in a non-departmentally organized college. And then the question is whether you want to extend it more generally. University Appeals Panel procedure, I guess that's ahead. 4C, appeals number 3, appeals decided on the record and so on. The issue of whether the provost should file a written response to the appeal, assuming the choice remains not to attend, is not addressed and has been a source of concern in a variety of instances. It really seems to me there are two questions there. One, I think you probably can't require a respondent to appear even at the initial hearing, so I think probably that should be left alone. But the question of whether the provost should file a written response, even if to say I believe my position in the matter is fully developed in my response to the initial hearing panel, to be simply be explicit about that.
Okay.
Under other university policies, 6C, the administrative review process, have we talked about this?
No, I haven't.
Who I've raised with, perhaps with Terry. Mm-hmm. I said it seemed to me that there may be some merit to actually look at the merits of continuing or discontinuing that procedure. And that would entail some assessment of what use that is made. My impression is, certainly not in all, but in a good fraction of cases, it's used as a means of gathering information by a potential grievant, which then ends up in the grievance procedure, and it really is not a resolution process. There are other cases in which it works well. And of course, the concern is that you end up from a process perspective, and I would say probably from an administrative perspective, that you end up doing things twice because you've got to respond to the administrative review. So I'm not sort of arguing against the provision, but to say that one might look at that, and there's nothing on the next page. Okay, let's see. Under faculty grievance official C, this is the request and have broad access to all information. I wrote down here, appeal of FGO decisions in such matters. My reaction is I would say no, and I think really the question is, that is, you could construe that as a decision. Now, it's not in the litany of the five, whatever it is, the six, five or six questionnaires. But whether one needs to be clear that that's a determination that rests with you or at the person.
Access to information?
Yeah, making the decision to request the information.
Okay.
And conceivably, you could argue that there is confidentiality matters that can't be addressed by redacting names or whatever.
Hmm. So maybe add it to this, there's seven, but FGO duties and jurisdiction?
It's a question.
Okay.
I think of the case, the old phrase, you know, hard cases make bad law.
Mm-hmm.
That you're probably aware that this was an extension person who was in Madagascar.
Mm-hmm. I was involved.
You're involved in that? And there
yes,
was the,
counsel.
There was the allegation that I can't remember, you probably know the particulars of it, but the question of his interaction with staff there, and they were
whether or not he had weapons and
weapons
threatened
and they
people.
Were going to threaten them and so on. And
yeah.
So the question then was, well, what was the, you know, what were the allegations that he'd made?
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, the sheriff, I guess, was Larry Ham, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Aggie refused to provide the information, and Michael never really pursued the matter.
Well, I had a more recent information problem with vet medicine.
Yeah.
In the one you were referring to, we did the first stage, the initial hearing, with me present as counsel for the grievant. The grievant was on telephone.
Yeah, overseas,
speakerphone,
right, yeah.
And I think we may have done it at ComArts because we couldn't do it at the grievance office.
Yeah.
He came to town for the appeal, however.
Yeah.
Along with his wife.
I remember that. This is a long time ago, isn't it?
Oh, it was one that I did as counsel in my mid to early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in any event.
Long ago. I don't know. I don't recall the information part of it. I recall the hearing and the speakerphone. But about 3 years ago, I had one related to information not being provided to the FGO by the general counsel office.
Yeah, I remember
with
that.
With vet medicine.
Oh, I remember the one with osteopathic medicine.
I think it was vet, but maybe I've got them wrong.
Well, this was the one that finally ended up that they were minutes of a meeting, which was a public document anyway.
Yeah, it's the same. We're talking the same case.
There was all this storm and during and so on.
This has been distributed to everyone and their brother and sister and so on. Under H on this, which is the FGO reporting to UCFA and so on, mm-hmm. and shall sit as an ex officio member, mm-hmm. There are two issues there. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a good idea. Now, as you know from the history, that it is only Michael Rubner and then you who have ever sat regularly with UCFA.
Okay.
The earlier FGOs consciously did not engage mm-hmm. because they really wanted to only come and deal with UCFA when they needed some kind of advice.
Do you think that was...
I think the arrangement of involvement is uh-huh. Useful, if for no other reason, for informational purposes, mm-hmm. that you understand a variety of things. So I would be in favor of that.
Uh-huh.
I think you probably need, you would probably need to institute an amendment in the bylaws for academic governance.
Oh, okay.
As well as in the procedure, because you would have to put it under the provision of UCFA as an addition to membership. But I don't disagree with the idea.
I mean, one can continue doing it without putting it in there, but I guess partly I was thinking some of this stuff should be codified so that the next FGO doesn't have to sort of guess and or figure out institutional memories when some of those institutional memories may not be available to sit here and chit-chat with the next person. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably true. If failing that, simply a statement of what custom and practice has been for 20 years mm-hmm. and the provision that I assume the UCFA, through its chair, could decide not to invite the UCFA.
Absolutely.
The FGO, so...
Yeah, no, it just... I don't mind going once a month to academic council. I even occasionally go to faculty council when there are things that are going to change bylaws. But the much more useful interaction is UCFA interaction. The other is kind of just...
But the provision that is suggested wouldn't give mm-hmm. the UCFA an option. You would be... Mm-hmm. The FGO would be an ex officio member.
No, that makes sense. Okay. You said there were two points to that.
Well, that's sort of raising the pros and cons of the idea. And secondly, I think you can't just change the grievance procedure. I think you have to change the bylaws for academic governance as well.
Okay, gotcha.
Under Appendix A, now this may be a note that doesn't make any sense. I made a reference. Under 1, UCFA, this is on the appointment of support mm-hmm. of FGO, UCFA shall prepare a slate of candidates for presentation and discussion with the provost and president.
Mm-hmm.
And I say no change from one person proposed by UCFA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, personally, I think there's some merit in that. The problem historically and the reason for the original provision is uh-huh. the president appoints a cream puff.
Uh-huh.
Or someone who's not terribly efficient and
uh-huh.
no one ever gets matters addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is that you pick the person and the president either has to say yay or nay. We've had, I think, only one case in the history of the appointment of the FGO in which the president did not endorse the recommendation of the
mm-hmm.
UCFA and they had to go back and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that may be a quasi-hot-button matter. Because implicitly, as written there, the president picks the FGO
mm-hmm.
after interaction regarding a slate of candidates. Now, there are ways in which one can address that. You can make some reference to... as we do with deans, if the UCFA or whoever's doing it specified a rating of these candidates in terms of strengths and weaknesses.
So would you leave in the language after which it shall recommend one person to be appointed?
Which one point is that?
In Appendix A1, the first one. You're referring to the first one?
I would not, but I think what I would do is to specify that there be some rating with strengths and weaknesses.
That UCFA should provide.
Yeah, and the president should then meet with the either the full committee or the subcommittee, whatever the committee's preference is, to explain the decision that they've made.
Okay.
So that it's clear that if the president chooses not to really follow the implicit advice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could make it stronger and to specify that in addition to strengths and weaknesses, the mode is that the candidates be ranked.
Mm-hmm.
You could rank people equally, but and the president would then pick the person, but there would be a chance to explain either orally or in writing the reasons for the decision. And in the case in which the president agreed with the recommendation, simply say, you know, I found the recommendation of the panel, of the committee cogent, and I recommend, I will recommend blogs as FGO.
Gotcha.
So it seems to me the one person thing I think was put in so that this would really be a faculty controlled position.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bit awkward, particularly candidly when you have a mode, and I don't think that there's ever been an overwhelming number of candidates for this position, that you end up with a fairly small pool of people.
Mm-hmm.
In Roman 2, evaluation of the FGO, I guess it's okay under 3. I would prefer to use the term in the last sentence, who have had contact with the faculty grievance policy in the FGO. I would refer to it as a procedure, but I guess it could be left as a policy. And those are the comments that I made. The major ones are the definition of administrators may be too narrow.
Mm-hmm.
The professional competence reference may be unduly narrow. I would use the jury-like selection for appeals, and question mark of the panel administrator response times too long. In terms of stretching the process out with a question mark at the end.
Okay.
So all in all,
thanks.
If you look at it, it's a set of recommendations which, you know, taken in the round are not unreasonable. There are bits and pieces here and there. And I don't know, as I say, I sent all this stuff to Christine and Terry and Donna, and I have no idea whether they just stuffed it in the waste paper basket or whether any of the items that were suggested found their way either in or didn't find their way in after some intense discussion.
Well, I can tell you a couple and do it in terms of my reactions and questions in a couple areas that I still have. I talked to you about this late last fall and then maybe early winter. And then shared with you my January draft.
Yeah.
The jury system was not in play then. That came out of conversation with Kim much later, maybe April or May.
Yeah.
But several of the other things were suggested then. And there are certain areas that I think everybody is in agreement. The 21 days has got a little questioning, but a lot of the other days there's like no disagreement. So, for example, getting rid of 72 hours for delivery of materials. Everyone seems to like the idea of 7 days or 10 days. And no one can sort of explain why in the world somebody came up with 72 hours. It's just been there a long time.
Well, you know, the history of it is a kind of reds under the bed perspective, which is people are going to sit on production of materials. And the process is going to get drawn out, and so you need to provide a crisp, fairly short deadline. And then, of course, 72 hours. Some wise colleague years ago came up with something that is, what, 3 days? Well, I guess you still have in the procedure that days are calendar days. Is that right? Well, then you get a query that's exercised at noon on a Friday, and you know, you're pretty much out of business on the 3 days by noon on Monday, and the person says, I didn't even know about it, you know. So I didn't have any reaction to that.
Right. So there's certain things that there's been pretty unanimous opinion that changes. There are some that there's been more discussion, dispute, and different thoughts about. Okay, and so one of the areas that I'm still not supportive of, to put it sort of bluntly, is this whole issue about excluding the provost. I also, well, we can do them one at a time or however, but the suggestion here is that the, as you recall, I guess the original procedure early on, the president was made someone who couldn't be, or the president and general counsel. I believe it's pretty much because of the kind of frequent filer problem in the late 90s into the early 2000s, adding the FGO and general counsel staff members as exclusions were added, because there were some people kind of playing with the system and upset, and basically you just filed grievances on the grievance official and the general counsel staff members if you didn't like what they did about something. And so there would be multiple grievances filed against multiple respondents all about the same thing. Now the suggestion is being made to add the provost to the list of people who can't be grieved. And my initial reaction is that that's a mistake, for a couple reasons. One relates, though, to a question about administrators and the issue about associates' role. This is also suggesting that it's just the heads of administrative units, meaning deans, directors, and chairs. And I understand that the thought from the general counsel or the provost office on doing that is that chairs, deans should be the one responsible. They're really responsible for the decision, even if their associate or assistant is the one who does something that a faculty member feels violates it. I'm not sure that's a wise decision, but one can argue that there's a logic to doing that, but I think it particularly plays out funny then if you're going to exclude the provost, because quite frankly, in a lot of RPT decisions, the dean isn't always making just an independent judgment. The dean sort of listens to what the three people working for the provost have to say when they review the files. And we've had cases, quite frankly, where deans have even, that the grievant found out that the dean changed his or her mind from what the dean originally thought, and then after the meeting with the three associates to the provost, they say, well, here from this broader perspective, this isn't as strong as you think it looks. And so I recommend you go back and rethink it. And the dean then says to the person, no, you're not reappointed, you're not promoted, you're not tenured.
Just to cycle back on this case, I don't think I would agree with the argument that you make in the scenario that you described, because in fact, the dean can get advice and commentary from a whole variety of circles. Mm-hmm. Unless you argue that the dean has no authority to mm-hmm. discontinue or to disregard the commentary they get in the discussion, that's still the dean's decision. It may be a modified decision, mm-hmm. but it's still the dean's decision. Mm-hmm. Once saying that, though, I would generally agree not to exclude the provost, uh-huh. because there are at least two instances in which the provost would conceivably make a decision. You could have the case that you've described in which the dean goes back, thinks about all these things, says, no, I think we should really promote or tenure
right.
Jones. And the provost, because in those cases, in terms of practice, the terrible trio or some representative of the terrible trio is going to go to Kim or whoever's there and going to say, you know, what are we going to do? And Kim may say, no, I've you give me the file, I've listened to what you have to say, I'm willing to talk with the dean, but at the end of the day, I'm going to say the person shouldn't be mm-hmm. appointed. And the provost is really making the decision. And that's what's implicit in terms of the, mm-hmm. The reappointment, promotion, and tenure process. These decisions are reviewed successively at each level. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that there may well be matters that the provost makes a decision on. For example, I remember a case, it was kind of a funny case in some respects, but some person, well, the department was moving.
Mm-hmm.
The individual was writing the equivalent of a great American novel, you know, mm-hmm. his great book of his
sure.
culmination of his career, and he had the department was in one of the older buildings, and he had this huge office, and he had everything sort of laid out, chapter
okay.
one and two and so on, and he and the decision was made to really provide that space to another unit, and the department was shifted elsewhere, and the office was not unreasonable as an office, but
mm-hmm.
it didn't have this, you know,
yeah.
you know, this huge
sure.
space. Well, that emanated ultimately from a decision by the, whatever the committee is, the committee that signs a space
mm-hmm.
in the university.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the implicit notion is for academic space, the provost is lead ultimately on those
okay.
decisions. And the provost was a potential respondent. Now, to end the story, and you know from your experience what kind of outcome it is, they pressed the faculty member, well, how long do you need this space?
Mm-hmm.
And it started off by saying, well, it's hard to say, you know, and so on. And so they really pressed them and said, you know, we're willing to defer the move for a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the conclusion of that, you really got to decide that you're
mm-hmm.
going to go. And the faculty member and the council decided that they'd best not sort of
mm-hmm.
pursue it. Now, there may be a variety of other matters in which the provost would make decisions. Now, the mechanism, of course, which is implicit, but again, maybe need to be articulated clearly, is how does the procedure operate in that mode. In a sense, you end up with a one-step hearing process,
mm-hmm.
and the president is really the receiver of the panel's recommendation and the final decision maker. There's no appeal
mm-hmm.
because the first level is.
So if the provost is the respondent, you just skip the first step.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's happened on a couple of occasions.
What do you, that's helpful. What do you feel about the issue about excluding any and all kinds of associates, including the provost office, versus it's just the head of that unit, it's they're the respondent. If they want to delegate it to, however you phrase it, Jones or
yeah.
whatever, that they do that, and it's their choice, but make all deans, directors, and chairs the respondent. Don't allow a grievant to say, well, I really, and here's how they would phrase it to the FGO. I really don't have any complaint to the dean as far as I know. In fact, I like the dean and I want to keep my relationship with the dean. I want to get back to administrative review.
It's the assistant dean.
But it's the assistant that hates me. It's the assistant who's making the wrong decisions. It's the assistant who came out of my own unit and we haven't gotten along in 20 years. However they phrase it, and I've heard many of those different
yeah,
ones,
I understand that.
Their point is I don't want to grieve the dean. I want to grieve the person who I think is causing the problem.
I understand
that's how they would phrase it.
I understand the argument that you immediately get into the wavy line issue
mm-hmm.
of is the person really a decision maker or a decision implementer.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there is a long-standing practice, which is widely understood in the unit, about course assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that is doing the actual assignments
mm-hmm.
is the assistant chair.
Very common.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules and the procedures for arriving at those decisions really are made by the chair. There's probably advice over the years from the
mm-hmm.
Department Advisory Council. So is the, the assistant chair may be a son of a bitch and make your life miserable and so on, but is that person really the decision maker if they are implementing practices, policies, and
mm-hmm.
procedures that are developed in the unit? And
the grievance isn't over the procedures. The grievance is likely
over the outcome.
The outcome.
Over the outcome.
Yeah.
But the outcome may be a direct result mm-hmm. of what the operating principles are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to get a classroom unless mm-hmm. you have at least 50 students, or, you know, those sorts of considerations. So I understand the impulse, and I'm mm-hmm. just sort of conflicted about that.
I'm not unsympathetic to the notion that there's a certain way that it makes HR more sensible to exclude assistants and associates. But I also know that the practicality often, either of the kinds of reasons that I was suggesting, is different. And the person really isn't grieving the chair or the dean.
Okay. Now, to go back to the other question,
but
the question of the provost
office,
being
yeah.
a respondent. The provost, if I was provost, I would be concerned with the whole variety of domains of the current structure, associate provost,
mm-hmm.
Really being the potential respondent for grievances which flow from the actions of these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Because you essentially have not only an enhanced workload, but you then have to spend a lot of time to get into the particularities of an mm-hmm. instance in which you're really relying on the commentary and perspective of the particular associate provost. So would it be possible to in instances in which the provost has delegated those decisions, for the provost to have someone to stand in for him with the understanding that person was really designated as the decision maker? In other words, you don't want to get into a mode in which someone says, well, you know, it's really Doug Easterby's decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through all of that and the outcome is, well, that was really only a recommendation to the provost.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think that would be a concern, and probably a legitimate concern.
Yeah. No, I don't see an easy answer. But I do see that the university has changed in my years, even being involved with the grievance office as counsel and now FGO, in terms of the expanded role of and number of associate provosts.
Mm-hmm. And then you apply that argument to colleges as well.
Right. And many colleges now have, I mean, there was a sort of tradition of having an assistant or an associate for certain things broken off, sometimes having two, sort of research and grad and scholarship versus undergrad and teaching. But now some are even have people who are really sort of HR, personnel questions and et cetera, et cetera. And some have associates and assistants, and it's quite a number. And so, yes, one would hope that the dean knows all of the players and who's making what decisions, but I can't imagine in those grievances that the dean's going to do anything but tell that person, you take care of this. You know.
The other option, so, which again is equally murky because uh-huh. The title designation of associate, in principle, if you look at there is a policy document that describes on the use of titles and what they mean. And associates are really people that have delegated authority and responsibility.
There's an MSU document that defines associates. And
well, in terms of the use of titles, now we're not altogether pristine in terms of that, because there are some people that plump for associate titles. Some people view them as promotions rather than
mm-hmm.
definitions of assignments, but you might want to play with the notion of whether or individuals holding the title of associate vice president or associate dean, associate chair, could also be respondents. Now, I would assume you would not want a mode in which a dean or a chair, for example, could say, well, the grievance is filed against so-and-so, who's the assistant or associate dean or assistant or associate chair,
mm-hmm.
and I have delegated operational responsibility, but I'm responsible ultimately for all the decisions made, and therefore the wrong respondent has been identified, and I'm the respondent, and I'll mm-hmm. respond. Mm-hmm. And I think you wouldn't want a mode in which you would prevent that from happening.
No, and I think it's partly to sort of speed up and not confuse people, too.
Yeah.
So that's an area where there isn't agreement yet.
The
areas of excluding the provost, I oppose that change, and I'm not as firm about the assistant and associates, but I have concerns about
is
that.
Is the element in the what is the argument about the provost? The provost makes no independent judgments that would impact on
why does someone list the provost?
Yeah, as an exclusion. I understand the president. The president's the final decision maker.
Yeah.
And the general counsel's office, I think the history you've described is reasonable. Mm-hmm. And these are counselors.
And I guess the notion of general counsel is they're not making decisions.
Yes,
they're providing advice.
Yeah, they're advisors.
And advice always in legal terms is advice.
Right.
It's not.
Yeah.
I can't speak for why this exclusion has been added. I don't agree with it.
Well, I understand that, but there was some discussion about that.
And I can't recall.
You can't recall it. Okay.
I'm sorry.
I think to be blunt, you're not talking about, 400 decisions in a year that impact an individual faculty member. But there are cases in which the provost makes an independent decision.
In my 4 years as FGO, in my dozen plus as counsel, but I only did, 3 or 4 a year, but a few. There were a couple instances where Luanna Simon was grieved against, and there were a couple instances where Bob Banks was grieved against.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they were all by the two frequent filers.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong, but all the ones I'm familiar with was the same two fellas.
Yeah.
And they were also the two that grieved against the general counsel, the general counsel staff, and the FGO.
Uh-huh.
And they're also one of whom who wrote letters to state senators, trustees, and so forth. So going way back to a comment you made earlier about not letting law be made by a few bad apples, bad examples, however you want to phrase that, this strikes me. It's also an issue, I imagine, that the provost is the decider at the first level in the grievance procedure. And perhaps that's the argument. But then I think the response you made is you skip that step in the grievance procedure.
For me, the major question, since a lot of these have to do with reappointment, promotion, and tenure, if you read our procedures, it talks about decisions being made at each level. So someone has to be grieved against at the third level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether the provost explicitly delegates that to Terry Curry or whoever else, or it rests there, but the provost's office makes a decision. And the summary that goes to each dean
mm-hmm.
in mid-April or late April says, this is the summary of the decisions of the office of the provost on your recommendations regarding reappointment, promotion, and tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, to me, it's I have no question it's wasting everybody's time to have somebody grieve about, I got the worst office, I got the stupidest grad assistant to the provost. That's making mockery of it. On the other hand, on the decision not to tenure somebody,
I think procedurally it runs in the other direction.
So anyways, that's one.
One.
You were looking at your watch, so we've
got... No, I just wanted to see what time it was.
Okay.
I had plenty of time.
So. I'm very bothered by the suggested changes in the grievance procedure. These are twofold. One is the statement that adds in the procedures contained in this policy are not available to challenge the desirability of unit policies. I do think I understand the general counsel and or provost office point there, which is the grievance procedure shouldn't be replacing governance. That if people don't like what's coming through governance and that then they should go there. On the other hand, the sentence itself to me I think is overly broad and unnecessary.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think you do have to say that if the policy is X, Y, or Z, it may be misbegotten, but it's got to be
misapplied, misinterpreted, you can't really say, well, you know, we have a policy duly authorized all the way through the governance process, and we're now going to grieve the fact that the policy exists.
Yeah, and I think that's Christine's point, is that it...
So I think maybe it's a footnote or something that says that. I don't know to what extent that's... are there instances that they would cite that that's been a problem? Because my... Again, you would have more day-to-day knowledge, but my impression is that we've not had cases in which people have used the procedure to grieve against the currently operational policy.
I'm not sure. I'll have to ask that. I'm also very bothered about the professional competence sentence. I believe, and I've said to all involved, that I think that could be simply used to throw out challenges to every RFP decision.
I agree. I made that point in the overview with them as well.
I understand it could be said that's not what we intend, but leave that sentence in there. Almost could scuttle the procedure for RFP, and if you're going to do that, then I guess, well, it just becomes meaningless. On the question about time limits, I don't think it's a good idea to add. It's been explained to me that the word that was thrown in here is generally. So it's saying generally time limits, and that it still allows latitude to the grievance official. I guess I'd go back to kind of a variation on what you just said. What are the instances where you feel the current FGO or its predecessor was abusing this? And I guess I know what some of the issues are, but I disagree. There aren't that many grievances being filed. This isn't.
No, as I was suggesting in the comments, mm-hmm. you might end up with a for example or an mm-hmm. EG, because I think you wouldn't disagree that any of those reasons are potential reasons for an extension.
Right.
But it's not an exclusive list.
Right.
And the generally question sort of allows some wiggle room, but mm-hmm. without any.
Mm-hmm.
The other way of going it is to say that in terms of granting extension, is perhaps an awkward way of doing it, the FGO is charged to make a balancing judgment between an expeditious implementation of the procedure and fairness to the parties and being able to present relevant evidence or something like that, which is kind of an enjoinder, but I think that's probably, how long has it been since you stopped beating your wife sort of question. So, I wouldn't be unhappy just to can that sentence, but I think you could live, I guess, with getting rid of generally and do a including but not limited to, for example, kind of language, which makes it clear that there are other options. I think one of the cases or one of the factual issues that I would be interested in knowing, and I assume at the end of the day this all gets discussed with the UCFA because these mm-hmm. are changes in the procedure, is if you look historically over some reasonable period of time, how often are you extending time limits?
Mm-hmm.
And a general sense of you know, what kind of purpose those extensions are providing. And that may then evolve into the other question that mm-hmm. says, well, this world will be easily addressed if we just simply add another week on the mm-hmm. On the list today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That might be a very useful way to go. Because it may then become obvious that the extensions for administrators are as common as grievance. I don't know. Something that did not get put in here that Christine and I have discussed is whether or not we should be clear about consolidation language in here. You may recall that part of what started this was my desire to see some things that are in user's guide be more clarified into being the procedure, if that's what they are, rather than just kind of a manual of guidance. And one of the things that only appears in the user's manual is the FGO's right to, after discussing with the parties, consolidating similar grievances. And the procedure itself doesn't really speak to it. So
would that be with mutual agreement of the parties? Or
well, that's a good question. Do you think it should only be if there's mutual agreement, or?
Well, no, I would in favor of a broader role for the FGO. I think the FGO would be required to consult with the parties and get mm-hmm. commentary about consolidation. But I think we'd be able to make a decision which would not be appealable.
Okay.
That would be my view, but that's probably something worth doing.
I mean, it's something I don't do a lot, but it quite frankly was very important in kind of ending the frequent filer backlog.
If this version got endorsed with, you know, whatever changes you were talking about, would you end up having no user's manual?
I had hoped so in the spring. The last conversation Christine Zako and I had, I think we sort of thought it's probably not possible, but it could be a very short, clear document.
More procedural stuff. What do you do? What do you have to write? You know, yeah. What does this mean?
But no, it didn't seem like we could.
What about all those long collection of UCFA advisory judgments?
I'd like to put them in a file. I find that a very confusing way because they're not in any document. They're kind of unfootnoted footnotes. I mean, they appear as notes at the end, which you wouldn't know which one to look at or why you'd look at it. It's other than the FGO can say if somebody gives them a hard time or causes a question or something. By the way, in 1998, the UCFA looked at this question, and here's what they advised the FGO. I just think those that matter, like a statement of confidentiality, and I already did this and it's been agreed, should just go into the procedure and just should say that everybody should be confident.
I think the problem of simply taking them all and sticking them in a drawer, you then live in a world of gotcha. Oh, here, you know, 1978.
No, my point is that those that matter and are important ought to be put into a policy, yeah. Whether it's the procedure or a user manual, but they shouldn't be unfootnoted appendix. The page limit one, I think, is another example of it's we had a problem. We had a person, actually not one of the frequent filers, who came in with whatever 400 or 500 pages of stuff, and so Michael said this is insanity and went to UCFA and they agreed. Or your idea of only 200
well, that
is fine.
One is fine to keep in the drawer. You pull that out when the person comes in with the 400 and says, no, we're not. Well, by what authority? Well, you know, this has happened before in the UCFA, et cetera. So those I understand.
But no, the others, no.
The
absolutely.
The others, the extent to which you can put them in the procedure.
No. I think we still have, I'll try to go kind of quick. We still have a question about new documents. At both the initial hearing and at appeals. At initial hearing, the current procedure is, I think it'll be somewhat solved because people will see things a week or 10 days before instead of 72 hours. And I think the 72 hours kind of encourages people to say something different.
That's true.
But the current procedure is that we put it into after opening statements, the panel can decide whether or not to accept. At appeals, the basic procedure sort of says there shouldn't be any new documents, but yet the practice has been to frequently allow some under the same rule. And there's been some conflict between the general counsel and the grievance office. I don't know if the provost office took an opinion ever. So I think that one's not sort of settled yet.
Although I think the way of addressing, I understand that it's a kind of legal perspective, which is appeal on the record, and what's ever in the record is on the original hearing is what you address. And I think you probably need some language that talks about the general expectation under which, mm-hmm. circumstances under which materials, because otherwise, mm-hmm. if there's nothing, then you end up rehearing the whole.
Absolutely.
The whole matter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, including a justification, because I would guess there are very few smoking guns that are found. It's materials that were available all the way along, and the grievant and counsel either weren't sharp enough to put it in initially or forgot about it. And so one of the criteria would be for the committee to determine, for the panel to determine, is the rationale put forward by the grievant. It's usually the grievant, although there's a respondent. There are respondent cases as well. Mm-hmm. Why it is that the document or the material was not included in the original set.
Mm-hmm. They're kind of...
And the expectation is that you can't say, well, I sort of forgot, or I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't take the process seriously enough.
I think there are four others that are kind of still...
Yeah, sure.
FGO is gatekeeper in jurisdictional. This FGO doesn't feel that the current system works very well. And the current system is, as I've been practicing it, grievant grieves. I'll check the website to make sure they actually are employed, maybe check a couple other things, but basically otherwise take them at their word that they only found out about the sex days ago, and yada, yada, yada. That then goes to the respondent. They read this and say, I told Jones a year ago.
2 years ago, right?
This isn't news. You've been hoodwinked. Different things. So there's a set of scenarios that the FGO gets told that, and if you would have just called me before, it would have been
right.
Fine. Okay. Then there are responses where the respondent is really arguing the case. So we have a couple different things that can happen here. My feeling was, while there are some advantages in making those simple calls, I also think that you take some risks in doing that you get convinced on the merits of the case that you should make a jurisdictional ruling against, and the grievant doesn't know that this is what's happened, but yet the FGO goes and says, sorry, I'm ruling against you. And so I thought, and it's sort of how much of a gatekeeper, and I think Kim's quite clear, he wants the FGO to be a much bigger gatekeeper so junk stuff doesn't get into the system. And so he doesn't have deans, directors, and chairs coming and telling him, why are you letting Rivette waste my time?
So there's, for me, there would be several issues on that. One is the latter point, to what extent is that an accurate description of what goes on?
Mm-hmm.
How many cases...
Mm-hmm.
That end up having to be responded to by a respondent,
mm-hmm.
And resubmission of the material,
mm-hmm.
even in instances in which you change your mind on that basis,
mm-hmm.
or it goes to the appeals panel,
mm-hmm.
On fairly straightforward sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the answer to that is. The other question is there some way on issues like is the person a faculty member, is the person a specialist, is the person an NSA?
Yeah.
Are there mechanisms that would enable your office through Access to University Data System to
yeah.
really be more definitive in terms
right.
of that?
And I'm not opposed to that.
The question of who the respondent is
mm-hmm.
goes back to the other question of who is really the decision maker, and the faculty member may know or may not know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other stuff is much more argumentative.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how cleanly you're going to be able to do that. But I think it is probably useful, again,
mm-hmm.
Kim responds like we all do to the dean who comes and spends his ear,
sure.
bends his ear, and it may be the one person in the year. So again, the extent to which there is some
documentary evidence and saying, is this a problem that we're solving for Dean X, or is this a systemic challenge?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think your idea of finding out numbers is very useful on that.
Because I think it's going to be very hard, much like the administrator question, to devise a bright and shining line.
Mm-hmm. As I say, I'm not opposed completely to the FGO having more. Just if it's going to be done, then there ought to be a paper trail. I think it's very risky if you make the FGO seem like a junior assistant in the provost office. And so we've had that discussion. The panel's jury system, I'm basically very favorable to that. I think it's an interesting idea. I was hoping by saying make it the same as sabbaticals, that wouldn't seem so onerous, so you wouldn't have, Deb's a little worried that you already have people who respond and say, how in the heck did you get my name? And you go, well, you volunteered or somebody volunteered you and you're listed for the next 2 years as a, in this pool, and if you're incorrect, you ought to take care of it. But she's just worried that it's going to be much more difficult and there's going to be probably a need for maybe a document that's a letter from the provost or something that isn't just my name that sort of says.
I think that's fine. But I think relative to where she is now versus other, there's probably going to be some different kinds of problems, but I don't think it's going to be much more onerous than the current arrangement.
Yeah.
And I think you may get a positive reaction if folks say, well, sure, I've been picked, but it is like jury duty, and you're not going to come back and ask me for another 7 years.
That's kind of my thought. When you make it 7 years, it shouldn't seem so. Anyways, like you say, there'll be some new tweaks, but I think in general it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm favorable. We have some issues about amendment deadlines. The current procedures at 5 days, that's been a disaster in my opinion. And we're now talking about, and Christine came up with kind of a compromise which makes it much longer, but has the FGO then deciding whether or not the amendment is allowed or not. Don't wait for the panel to have to do it. I think in general that's good, but the number of days is a little confusing.
Okay.
So that's something we've got to work on. I think this kind of goes back to the jury system. I should have tied it together. The standing appeals panel role is and details about it aren't really great. I think the anecdotal, and again, maybe I should just get numbers, the anecdotal sense is that the standing appeals panel always agrees with the FGO, and I've tried to demonstrate that's not true, but numbers might help clarify that a little more. But even if that's not true, that they don't always agree, I'll absolutely tell anybody. I remember an instance where they had two hearings, two to look at the FGO's decision, and I thought going in that the FGO made a mistake on one and was right on one, and so did they when they came out, but they did exactly the opposite. The one I thought I made a mistake that they said was fine, and the one I thought I did right they said was a mistake. And it's like, well, something's wrong, because either I'm totally not understanding some things or they're not. And so it, you know, it's always hard to say, and jury systems are funny systems, just as judge systems are funny, but it'll be interesting, and let me just tell you a quick aside. We had two cases just in the last couple weeks that are finally gone to hearings that arose from two people who jointly filed a grievance, arising out of the same situation. I then told them you can't file a joint grievance, you have to file separate ones. We then separated the two. We went through a whole business about them, the respondents appealing that this isn't legitimate, et cetera, et cetera. We finally got to hearings, okay? And we have two panels that heard those cases because they were now separated. Only I at this point know that those two sets of recommendations of the provost are unlikely to be identical. And yet the cases, while they were two different people, they flip-flopped each other. So one played grievance, one played counsel, and the opposite for the other case. And the two respondents are the same. And so the facts were not, well, not identical, we're awfully close to it. And it'll be interesting how the final statements get written by those two, and it'll be interesting to see what Kim thinks about it when he gets...
Right.
But my point is, I think that'll always be there as long as you... Whether we call the new system a jury system and this old one a governance, however we phrase it, they're still both jury recommendations to a judge.
Now, you're talking about a hearing panel in the last, and you began talking about the standing appeals.
I'm sorry, but my point is, there are always the human dynamics within a panel that even if they're presented with basically the same facts, if it's five different people in two different settings, when they then come together and look at the facts that were presented to them verbally and in writing, these five and those five may not arrive at the same decision.
But for the standing appeals panel, the theory, at least historically, was that since they serve, what, 2 years on a rotating basis or staggered basis,
yeah,
there would be some general experience that they would be able to draw upon. Now, whether it's precedent in a formal sense, I don't think so, but at least that they've been through not just one off. And so that they would have some sense of consistency. The question that, again, maybe I missed in the review is that one of the issues you've raised is whether or not the FGO should have the option or be required to provide commentary as long together with the parties when the matter is appealed.
The new revision compromises that the FGO would, if the FGO wanted, could resubmit a new decision or a new recommendation or say, I think I was wrong, and I think that solves much of that.
Well, it may, but if the FGO believes that the original decision was right,
mm-hmm.
and what you essentially have is the standard letter, you know, here are the six questions and so on, and so it's challenged. The respondent usually writes and says he got it wrong.
Right.
The grievant then weighs in. The question was, is it desirable to have the FGO have mm-hmm. an option if they choose to explain in
right.
more detail of how they came
right.
to the original judgment?
Right.
Doesn't mean that your view is right or correct or would be sustained,
right.
but at least provides more information.
Right. And I think we're on agreement to expand that.
Yeah.
Okay. And that may take care of the issue of the SAP. I guess what I was saying, and I wasn't very clear in explaining, it still, however, does depend on the dynamics and et cetera about those three people, just like it does with panels. And so
now, the case that you cite raises the related question, which goes back to the question of consolidation. Should there be an opportunity in instances in which you have,
oh.
I don't know what the case
yeah.
is involved, of having two grievances from the same unit and the complaint is over exactly the same issues, and the
mm-hmm.
answer is it may never be 100% accurate, but is there some possibility of combining a hearing so that there are two grievances and one respondent on the same set of issues and therefore one panel?
I don't think we've discussed it, but I think that makes a lot of sense.
Now, the answer is that it may be never used or used infrequently.
There have been several instances where I've had groups of people come in from a unit saying we can't take our leader anymore or whatever, and can we all file grievances? And they go, well, I'll meet with all of you together and talk to you about it, but each of you, if you want to file a grievance, needs to come on down here and file.
And it may be in those instances there are different burrs under the saddle.
Right.
And the answer may be you need to go and talk to your dean about getting a chair reviewed.
But at the moment, there's no way to consolidate those, and maybe there ought to be a way to consolidate multiple cases that are all about the same thing.
Yeah.
But
I think you've got to get more than just saying we don't like our chair, and therefore we want to consolidate agreements.
I was talking in shorthand.
Yeah.
It might be that they all come and say the chair is violating this bylaw,
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
No, it's got to be yeah. the same thing. Not just they don't like
so
it.
So that was a thought.
And the very last thing that's been is the issue about how many days. There are currently deadlines on the FGO, deadlines on hearing panels, recommendations, deadlines on the provost decision, deadlines on the president's decision. And you raised a good question or good suggestion earlier. Maybe you ought to find out how many times do you extend on those. Without doing that, my general sense was 14 days is becoming more and more problematic as we have people on more leaves, more Dubais, more Grand Rapids, and et cetera.
And so maybe 21 is fine. The question is, are we going to end up sort of having additional? I mean, I'd like to get a number in which way you wouldn't preclude an extension, but to have it rare and unusual rather than a normal practice.
Yeah,
so maybe we're sort of looking at that to see where you are.
So I think we spent all the time talking this. But I can schedule with her for picking up on the other things we talked about.
Yeah.
I really appreciate us doing this, though, because this is what's immediately in front of.